Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I'm here with Zsolt Darvas and Heather Graby. We are all senior fellows here at Bruegel, and we are going to talk to you today about Ukraine and its future alongside and possibly inside the EU. Heather, can you tell us, where is Ukraine going now? It's an official candidate, and as I understand, leaders will be meeting in mid-December to discuss whether to start official accession talks. But talks take a long time. So what's the decision coming up? And if they do start talks, what's the time frame for those talks?
They always take a long time, because joining the EU is it's a big thing. It means taking on the whole EU rulebook of, you know, famously more than 100,000 pages of legislation, meeting lots of requirements and so on. And that's even for a country which is not undergoing a full-scale war and needing to reconstruct itself before joining the EU and so on and so on. So the decision that's coming up right now is about starting the first stage. Ukraine got candidate status from the EU along with Moldova last year in 2022 in record speed, because the EU wanted to send a clear signal that Ukraine's future lies in the EU and that the EU will back Ukraine. That was really important as a political signal. It doesn't mean, however, that Ukraine will get a shortcut to accession, because becoming a member means accepting a country forever. And the key period when there's maximum incentive, motivation and resources for major fundamental reforms in a country is during the accession process. Once they finish the accession negotiations, nothing much necessarily happens after that. And in fact, there can be backtracking after accession, as we've seen in some of the member states. So this decision is important as a political signal. It's important to show that the EU can still be united around Ukraine's accession. But then the talks could take 10 years. It depends hugely on how the reconstruction goes. It depends how fast the Ukrainian public administration can be reformed, and a host of other factors.
We know in the past the EU tends to let countries in groups rather than trying to deal with them one at a time. Zsolt, can you remind us how the last big group came together and how long that took, and then what we're looking at with the collection of countries that are lined up now?
There were three rounds of Eastern enlargements. The biggest one was in 2004, when 8 Central European countries, along with Cyprus and Malta, joined. Bulgaria and Romania came 3 years later in 2007, and Croatia in 2013. Now, the big enlargement in 2004, I think, was a very successful effort, because, you know, before that there were talks, you know, some countries were better prepared than others, and there were discussions, you know, whether to let those countries which progressed faster earlier. But at the same time, there was a sense that if countries join together, I mean, this might also lead the countries which are performing worse to speed up and accelerate their efforts. And I think this was quite a useful decision to let a big enlargement at the same time. Again, there also the talks lasted for many, many years. I mean, started in the mid-late 1990s. But towards the final years, many countries accelerated their efforts to meet the accession criteria. And ultimately, it worked out well.
Yeah, I think the key thing to remember is that the EU kind of has to do groups for two reasons. One is because it's the best way to encourage positive competition between the countries, because no prime minister wants to be the one to go and tell his voters, the country next door, they're doing better, they're going to join before the EU, we have to wait a few years. Already, that was a huge problem for Romania and Bulgaria when they had to wait till 2007. And the other reason why is because the EU member states, each of them has to ratify every one of the accession treaties. So it's really hard to go back to national parliaments and even in some countries to a referendum on accession for a whole series of different treaties. You want to do it in one clump, make the argument, hey, this is, you know, historically important. This is the best way to manage all kinds of issues. You don't want to have to be doing that 1 year after the next.
So we've got 10 countries in various stages of trying to join the EU. This includes Turkey, which people don't think is going to have talks going anywhere anytime soon, and also Georgia, which hasn't quite made it to official candidate status, but which is regularly cited as part of the
area whose future is in the EU. How do some of these other countries, particularly the good citizens, countries like Montenegro or North Macedonia that have worked really hard to meet the criteria, how do they feel about having such a big and important country like Ukraine coming and jumping the line?
There's been a lot of worries that somehow Ukraine might leapfrog and just get into the EU with a really fast accession process. I think that's pretty unlikely because of all of the requirements I was mentioning earlier. And in fact, what has happened is Ukraine and Moldova's candidacy has dynamized the accession process after many years of stagnation. On the whole, I think this is a good thing for the Western Balkans because it's forced the EU to take enlargement serious again as a geopolitical issue. The EU started thinking about, ooh, is it really such a good idea to have so much Russian influence in the Balkans? Is it great to have more Chinese influence in our neighborhood as a whole? They're looking at it differently from, oh, well, this is a difficult issue that can be put off. So that urgency is good for them. Also, it's really good, I think, to have the positive competition. It's really good that the more laggard governments in the Balkans, that their prime ministers are asked by the people, hang on a sec, why is it that Ukraine might move ahead of us? Why have these reforms not happened? Why are we slipping behind our neighbors? And that would call them to account more.
Scholz, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, let me add that also Charles Michel said that by 2030, the EU should be ready for enlargement, not just for Ukraine, but also for the Western Balkans. And quite importantly, in November this year, the Commission proposed a special instrument for the Western Balkans, which is called a New Growth Plan for the Western Balkans, which includes a number of specific programs and targets to include these six countries in the EU single market. And some can be very simple, like, for example, including in the single euro payment system, you know, allowing very free and fast payment services, or abolishing, you know, roaming fees between EU and the Western Balkans, helping telecommunication, but also many other sectoral integrations like the energy markets and so on. And also the Commission proposed a new growth fund for the Western Balkans, somewhat mimicking the Recovery and Resilience Facility, because it would dispose of 2 billion euro grants and 4 billion euro loans. And Western Balkans countries would need to submit so-called reform agendas to the Commission, detailing what kind of reforms they wish to do. And if they be able to implement those plans, they can get the funding. So this dynamism that Heather mentioned is also reflected in some of these recent proposals, which I think is forward-looking and indeed can help these Western Balkan countries to somehow emerge from this, you know, sleeping position of no real prospect for EU entry to something more dynamic, which can eventually lead to EU entry.
Charles Michel is, of course, the head of the European Council, which is meeting to decide where to move next on accession. Seems like there are a couple of issues in play. One of them is the general reluctance of the leaders who sit in this council to accept new members as a full peer because that dilutes their vote. And the other issue is Viktor Orban from Hungary. Heather, how do we make sense of this?
Enlargement is, even when it's a geopolitical imperative, always a scary thing for existing members because they're in this incredibly privileged position of being inside the wealthy country club. And many of them are, of course, net recipients from the EU budget, and they have votes on all of the EU policies, whereas the countries that are sitting outside the EU are policy takers rather than policy makers. So the fear of diluting their power inside the club is always going to be there. And that's why enlargement usually needs a geopolitical push to actually happen. The forces against it of all of the entrenched interests in the existing member states are pretty strong. And that's the case here too, especially with such a large country as Ukraine, large in terms of population and also potentially economically dynamic once it's in a reconstruction phase, we hope after the war. And what really needs to be thought about now is how the future EU might look with Ukraine as a member rather than focusing on who might lose out. Because if you just focus on that, you lose the perspective of the economic dynamism and the opportunities also for demographic renewal that could come from Ukraine's accession. Now, Viktor Orban, Hungary's current prime minister, has asked for a more profound debate about Ukraine's accession. So he's sort of trying to put his foot on the brake and revisit who knows what kind of range of issues. And those who see very strong geopolitical reasons for welcoming Ukraine into the European family, for example, President Macron, also Commission President von der Leyen, who've been really clear about this point, will be pushing against that and saying, yeah, we've had that discussion. And what's the alternative? The alternative is not supporting Ukraine, not sending the right kinds of messages, and frankly, you know, encouraging Russia in its attempts to take over Ukraine. And that's also very demotivating for the other candidates. And it essentially gives a much more an impetus towards Russian influence.
So it's a problem then that Orbán is blocking this on so many levels.
And also he's blocking the money for Ukraine to keep going right now.
This example really shows how the EU has gone from a purely economic arrangement to much more of a geopolitical strategy thing. Thinking back to the way the bloc has evolved, we had a situation where Greece was pulled into the euro, into the common currency, before people thought it was ready for political reasons. That didn't work out so well. But now there is a sense that the euro itself is a political tool as well as a currency, and more folks have been joining the euro. Bulgaria might make it in even at some point, despite having some ongoing question marks about its rule of law and other preparedness. Schultz, how do we sort out the EU from the euro, which everybody is expected to join, and the economic from the political in trying to find our way through here?
You are perfectly right. The economic and political motives for joining the euro strongly overlap. For example, for the three Baltic countries, which was in the past members of the Soviet Union, they also saw euro membership as a kind of additional security against the threat of Russia, because they believe that they might get stronger security guarantees from other EU countries or NATO members if they are not just members of the EU, but also members of the euro area. Now, you rightly said that Bulgaria also wants to join the euro. In fact, it wanted to join ever since it entered the EU more than 15 years ago. I mean, if you looked at the website of the Bulgarian Central Bank, they had one goal, joining the euro full stop. Now, it might take time to get there. Now, about the new candidates, I mean, still, you know, relatively early to speculate at what time they would join the euro. But I also do think that both Ukraine and also the smaller countries in the Western Balkans, after they enter the EU, it would be advantageous for them also to join the euro area.
When we come back, we'll talk more about the costs of bringing more countries into the EU and what it might mean for the economy. Welcome back. I'm here with Schultz Davis and Heather Graby talking about Ukraine and its prospects for joining the EU. Schultz, this is all going to be very expensive. The EU is already trying to pay for Ukraine reconstruction and will then be presumably assisting more as it tries to get ready for the EU. What kind of numbers are we looking at?
The numbers for reconstructions are really huge. There were an assessment jointly conducted by various institutions, including the government of Ukraine, the World Bank, the Commission, and other stakeholders. And they came out with numbers amounting to $400 billion, which is two or three times Ukraine's GDP. So reconstruction will be really, really costly. Now, a key issue is certainly who will pay for that and what kind of support that's going to be. Will it be, you know, just pure grants, which is very unlikely? More likely that also many Western companies will come in to invest and help to rebuild. And of course, this also means that they will get possession of new infrastructures and factories and so on that they actually rebuild. Another aspect of the financial discussions about Ukraine's entry is the impact on the European Union budget. And, you know, some numbers were circulating in the media from different calculations. We also did our own. And indeed, we do find that Ukraine will be a major beneficiary of the EU budget. I mean, let me mention just one fact about agriculture. Supposing that Ukraine will regain its full territorial integrity, so including the occupied parts by Russia, and also that some of, you know, the agricultural land is now extremely polluted and not usable for production. So suppose that all agricultural land will be usable for agricultural production, then it means that in the enlarged EU, 20% of the land, agricultural land, will be in Ukraine. So Ukraine will be the biggest agricultural producer of the European Union. But this is super good for the EU. I mean, we want to have, you know, greater food security. We want cheaper food prices. So having a large country joining is beneficial. Naturally, it also means that if the current common agriculture policy would not be changed, then Ukraine will be the biggest beneficiary of this policy. But again, this is something I have to say is right, because Western farmers have been receiving agricultural supports for decades. Also, farmers in Central Eastern Europe, they have receiving growing amount of funds ever since they joined the EU. So I think we shouldn't change agricultural funding when Ukraine joins. But indeed, I think equal treatment also implies that farmers in these countries will also require support. Now, cohesion is another area where Ukraine would get significant amount. But it's not very well known that in the current EU cohesion regulation, there is an upper cap, an upper limit, how much countries can obtain. And for the least developed countries, it's 2.3% of GDP. For example, it's currently limiting the amount that Poland can get. And it will also limit the amount that Ukraine would get. So Ukraine would get just one half than what currently Poland gets if this 2.3% upper limit remains in place.
And that's because Ukraine's GDP is about half of Poland's, is that right?
It's much, much lower than that of Poland.
So where do you get half, and 2.3% of whose GDP?
So 2.3% of each country's GDP for those countries that have the lowest level of income. For richer countries like, you know, Luxembourg and Germany, the upper cap is much smaller, but Ukraine is a very, very poor country. Its per capita income, measured at purchasing power parity, is less than one half that of Bulgaria. And, you know, Bulgaria is currently the country with the lowest level. So clearly, Ukraine has a very, very low level of income currently. Likely, during the reconstruction period, it will improve. But there are no miracles in economic development. It will take a long time for Ukraine to catch up. So whenever Ukraine will join the EU, it will still be the lowest income country in the bloc.
This is fascinating, and thank you for walking us through that. I mean, especially thinking about Poland, because some of these calculations have shown that Poland's share of the EU budget would practically zero out for countries that are net recipients. Poland would be kind of more or less on par with what it contributes and what it gets back compared to right now. And also, we've seen this frustration in Poland over Ukrainian agriculture imports coming in during the war. So presumably, both of these things would resolve a little bit if Ukraine actually joined the EU. But what happens there?
But let me qualify this point, whether Poland will become a net contributor, because I don't think that's the case.
I didn't see net contributor, but I saw that its net surplus would reduce. But perhaps your calculations are better.
Yeah, net surplus would be reduced somewhat, but not substantially. So again, some of the numbers circulating in the media, I think, are not well-founded.
I think we have to remember also the budget will be really very different by the time Ukraine joins anyway. There are other pressures on the EU budget, not only enlargement. There's the whole question about own resources, so the revenue side of the budget, also new priorities. You know, at the moment, agriculture and the cohesion funds take up the majority of the budget, but there are all kinds of other priorities like the climate transition, digital, also other foreign policy priorities. So there will be reforms of the budget, also to green agriculture and other adaptations over the years ahead. And the EU has many different ways of managing the budgetary impact of new members coming in. There can be transition periods. Poland, for example, took 10 years after accession to get full access to agricultural subsidies that would have been under the normal calculation. Plus, most of the reconstruction effort for Ukraine will be off budget because it'll be done through some kind of multilateral donor fund. So I think that we can't just assume that, okay, all of the cost of Ukraine's reconstruction is going to come from the EU budget. It almost certainly won't, or that Ukraine will join the current budget. So it's really important to have these calculations that Zsolt and colleagues have made about the real impact under the current rules. But we know that those rules won't apply. What's really important also to remember is it wouldn't be a good thing if they did, because Ukrainian agriculture is competitive on world markets without subsidies, whereas, you know, EU farmers are heavily subsidized. And also Ukraine has very famously rich and fertile soil, and to deplete it by applying the kind of very intensive agriculture methods that are used in the EU and subsidized by the EU would not be good for nature, biodiversity, and the regeneration of Ukraine's fantastic soil. And there will be huge costs for cleanup. Zsolt mentioned all of the pollution caused by the war. There's also huge numbers of mines. A quarter of Ukraine's territory has mines in it. So there will be need to be a big demining effort. So there's a lot of things that will change between now and Ukraine being fully part of the EU budget. What's important to remember is that Ukraine has a younger population than many EU member countries. It's, of course, suffering a terrible loss of its young men at the moment in the war, and also the destruction of so much infrastructure in Ukraine. But the reconstruction effort and the return, hopefully, of many Ukrainians to the country will lead to a period of economic dynamism and catch-up. Plus, the accession process will drive governance reforms that will help the economy to function a lot better and for the public administration to support competitiveness and a much better functioning market economy in the future. So we're not looking at the Ukrainian economy of the past, and we're not looking at the EU budget of the present.
And it's not just a question of money. It's also a question of people, as you just pointed out. We've seen in the past that the EU has, particularly with Bulgaria and Romania, made a gradual transition to having them be full members of the workforce and ability to live and work anywhere in the EU that they want. We also have seen the EU struggle to figure out how to handle its Schengen border-free travel arrangements, which apply to most countries in the EU and a few outside it, but not all of them. How do we look at this, Zsolt, and what are the economic implications there?
Look at the population development in some lower-income EU countries like Bulgaria, Romania, Latvia, and Lithuania. Then we see really dramatic declines over the past decades. I mean, population in these countries declined by 20-30%. Roughly about half of that decline or three-quarters of the decline was due to emigration. And let's say one-third of the decline was more deaths than births because of unfavorable demographic development and low fertility rates. Now, since income in Ukraine is even lower than in these countries, once free movement of mobility will apply to Ukrainian citizens, then I think it's quite likely that even a larger share of Ukrainians would decide to come to the EU. Now, this will be very bad for Ukraine because the country currently suffers from labor shortages. And if, you know, a couple of additional million people would leave, then it would be even more difficult to rebuild and also in the longer term to grow in the country. But on the other hand, for the EU, it would be absolutely beneficial. We can just look at the latest Eurostat projections for EU population published earlier this year, which suggest that the EU population, which was 450 million in 2022, would decline to just about 400 million by 2050 in the absence of immigration. Moreover, this roughly 50 million decline has a very unique composition because the number of elderly people is set to increase by about 30 million, while the number of children and working age decline even more. So European welfare system will be simply not sustainable if there is no immigration at all into the EU, and this so-called old age dependency ratio, you know, which measures how many working age people support old age people, will rise really dramatically. I mean, this is an unfortunate fact of life. Immigration would be needed. So if Ukrainians would come to the EU, that would be very beneficial for EU countries. And also, I mean, why I mentioned that it would aggravate labor shortages in Ukraine, but it still also can help a little bit Ukraine because immigrants typically send back quite some money home. I mean, we also see in the Western Balkans that remittances amount to 5 or 10% of GDP each year. And after some time, immigrants go back, and they go back with greater skills that benefit the home country. So I think full labor mobility applying to Ukrainian citizens would be very, very beneficial for the EU and also indirectly beneficial for Ukraine.
Could we see a situation where a lot of the migrants from outside the EU, where there's a lot of discussion about where they should go and where they should live, might end up going to Ukraine instead of some of the other countries that have expressed frustration with the number of folks trying to get in?
Yes. We also see in some Central European countries that why locals leave more to the west. People coming more from the east would be very happy to come. And, you know, sometimes they also come from Asia and Africa and many other places of the world. But, you know, the control of immigration from outside the EU will always be much stronger. And in any case, if an employer wants to employ an employee, you know, if the person is from the EU, it's super easy. You know, they just sign a contract. Nothing else needs to be done. But if that person is coming from outside the EU, then, you know, various permissions are needed. Also, the recognition of qualifications is always much more difficult. And so in many professions, it's not very easy to employ non-Europeans in European labor markets.
Remember that after accession, the EU usually has transition periods that the member states can apply on the new members. So in the case of the 2004-2007 enlargements, member states could keep people from the new members out for up to 7 years after accession. And some of the member states did actually make use of those transition periods. But the difference for Ukraine and indeed Moldova in comparison with those enlargements is that the countries will really want to hang on to their people. As Zsolt was saying, there were some major advantages to how many Poles, for example, went to work in other EU countries where they learned foreign languages, they built up some capital, then they were able to come back to Poland and start a small business, buy a house. That really kind of helped to keep Polish economic dynamism going, and it gave opportunities to younger Poles to have that international experience. But it's very different in a situation after a war, or indeed where there may still be some kind of conflict going on, perhaps lower level, but where essentially quite a lot of the manpower, literally of the country, will need to be reservists. So the need to keep the military supplied with people could still be there. And also the need for reconstruction will also cause Zelensky or whoever is president of Ukraine at the time to want to bring his people home. So, in fact, it may be the president of Ukraine who is the biggest opponent of free movement of labor after accession to the EU, precisely because he wants to have Ukrainians rebuilding the country and, you know, having children in Ukraine, bringing them up as Ukrainians, literally maintaining the Ukrainian nation. And that wasn't an imperative that was there in previous enlargements.
It just shows how complicated this all is. When we come back, we'll talk more about the war and the reconstruction and where we go from here. Welcome back. There's an active war in Ukraine right now. How do we square looking at what will happen after the war when the war hasn't stopped yet?
This is the really difficult part about this accession, because nobody knows what the circumstances will be. During the process of accession negotiations, so long as the central administration can continue to work on putting EU laws on the statute books and working through all of the requirements of the acquis communautaire, it can rumble along. There's an administrative capacity issue, but on the whole, it can go on. And we've actually seen countries get to the end of the negotiations without a resolution to the conflict on their territory. For example, Cyprus joined the EU as a divided island. Estonia did not have a border treaty in place with Russia when it joined in 2004. So the accession negotiations can go on. But of course, as the war is a horrendous absorber of lives and money, and that depletes Ukraine's capacities as time goes on. And then, of course, there are all of the geopolitical issues, as we were discussing earlier.
So what will the leaders need to do this week, leaving aside whether or not Orban blocks an immediate decision? What do they need to set the stage for? Are they looking at continuing the current system? Are they looking at trying to change the treaties to have a second tier of membership, to have a longer transition on some of these things? What's in front of them?
I would separate short-term issues, what to do, let's say, in the summit and in the coming months and years, and also for the more longer-term once Ukraine joins the EU. So in the short-term, I think it's absolutely essential to support the momentum which is currently exist. I mean, if you look at opinion surveys, I mean, the EU is the most popular country in Ukraine. I mean, even more popular than in EU members. The Ukrainian government, under difficult circumstances of the war, are trying to introduce and implement reforms which are necessary for starting negotiations. And I think these efforts and this enthusiasm about the EU should be maintained, should be supported, should be encouraged. And for that, I think declaring the start of accession talks would be a very positive signal. Now, clearly, Ukraine at the moment is not yet ready, even for starting the actual talks. Yet the Commission recommendation was, I think, very well drafted, because it suggested that the European Council should declare the start of the talks, but actual talks should just start later, once Ukraine further progress with improvements in its governance and rule of law. And we have seen in the case of Turkey that, you know, starting accession negotiations doesn't guarantee at all that the country will actually end up being in the EU. So I think in the short term, the most important is that Europe should speak with one voice and support Ukraine in its great difficulties of trying to implement governance reforms during the hardship of the war and the loss of human lives. But more in the medium term, in your second part of your question about whether there should be a second tier membership or so. So in my view, the major risk for the EU from an eventual Ukraine entry is that if there will be some backsliding on rule of law and governance measures after the country has entered into the EU. And we see in the current cases within the EU that current instruments are not very helpful and strong enough to help to address such situations. So one option, which was also proposed by the Franco-German expert group, which prepared a report for the European Council, is to use the accession treaties to introduce some special provisions, which would benchmark rule of law after accession. And if the country fails to meet those benchmarks or slides back, then there will be a much easier process to suspend veto rights and access to EU funds than what currently available in the EU treaties. Now, you might say that this could lead to a second tier membership, but I think when the choice is either no entry or entry with the condition that in the case of rule of law backsliding, voting powers will be suspended easier, then I think the choice is very, very clear that we should go for entry and a special new instrument to ensure that rule of law backsliding will not happen.
It makes a lot of sense. And we certainly have heard people say that the EU needs to get ready, just as the countries have to get ready. And that's different from the question of one country, one vote, because people also have been talking about, I mean, I don't think seriously, but often you'll hear people say having 35 countries who are all peers, who all have unanimity blocking is just too hard. And there ought to be some countries that don't get to vote in the same way as we get bigger. Do you guys still hear people talking about that? Or is that just sort of voter frustration?
No, there's a lot of talk about expanding the scope of qualified majority voting. There are some member states who'd be willing to accept it on foreign and security policy, for example. There are others that might accept it on tax policy. Those two groups don't necessarily overlap, which is the difficulty. But there are already plenty of provisions in the existing treaties to use, for example, the Passerelle clause and other ways of expanding qualified majority voting. But of course, everybody has to agree unanimously to expand it in the first place, which is the difficult part. And there are plenty of ways the EU can reform itself without opening up the treaties. I think it's extremely unlikely that there will be another major treaty reform. I put it on record. I offer a bottle of champagne to you, Rebecca, if the EU really does have a new treaty to replace Lisbon sometime in the next 10 years. I don't think it's going to happen. But what we could see are incremental reforms of various kinds. And as Jolt was pointing out, the group of 12 has come up with an interesting proposal for doing this through the accession treaties, which of course have the force of primary law. They're intergovernmental agreements ratified by all the member states. You can put all kinds of things into them. They still have to be agreed unanimously. So new provisions on the rule of law
The question is, would they only apply to the new member or also to the existing members? Now, ideally, they should apply also to the existing members because we have problems with rule of law and the uniform application of EU law in the current member states, most notably in Hungary, also in Poland, which hopefully the new government will now address. But if it only applied to Ukraine, Moldova, to other countries coming in, that would be unfair. We have in the EU various forms of differentiated integration, as it's called in the Brussels speak, i.e. countries not being fully part of every part of the EU. Some of them voluntarily, for example, Denmark and Sweden just don't want to join the euro, and there's no real pressure on them to do so, even though officially in the treaty, everybody has the obligation to join. Romania and Bulgaria are still outside the Schengen zone of passport free travel and would very much like to join it, but they're blocked by Austria and the Netherlands. And of course, then there are various opt-outs that the Danes had and various other things. So in practice, you can usually find solutions to issues. But the idea of Ukraine having survived an incredibly brutal war, lost, you know, maybe 100,000 of its people, then being told, okay, you can only join the EU in a permanent second tier, you're never going to be a first-class citizen, I can't see that happening. I can see definitely the EU perhaps developing new areas where only some member states participate. There's talk about having a supplementary budget, for example, partly to get around these problems with the existing members. But ultimately, Ukraine has to be fully in Europe.
As we close out this podcast, Schultz, any final thoughts or big takeaways you want listeners to come away with?
My main message is that the momentum should be keep going. I mean, Ukraine suffers a brutal aggression from Russia. The country has really major vulnerabilities and a very weak governance structure at the moment that they are trying to improve under these very difficult conditions. So Europe should stand with Ukraine and help the country to reform itself. And once Ukraine is ready to join, the EU should be ready to accept it.
We can't afford to have grey zones in Europe anymore. The alternative to Ukraine being fully part of the EU and going through this process is to have a Ukraine which may well have huge problems with corruption, governance, and also insecurity, and be taken over by Russia. This is a horrendous alternative for European security, for the European economy, for all of the countries not only bordering Ukraine, but all of those in Europe. So yes, there will be all kinds of complaints from those who fear that they'll lose their subsidies, that they may face more competition, that they might not have as much power in various institutions as they do now. But do they really want Russia on their border? Do they really want Russian influence to increase across the whole of the EU's neighborhood, because that's what will happen. If Ukraine and Moldova and the other countries are not brought further into European integration from now.
Thank you very much, Heather and Schultz, for joining me on this podcast. Thank you, listeners, for sticking around. You can find our research on Ukraine and enlargement and related issues on our website, Bruegel.org. You can find The Sound of Economics on all of your favorite podcast distribution channels, and we look forward to seeing you in the future. Thanks very much, and have a good day.